Support for Science Friday comes from 23andMe. Your DNA is made up of 23 pairs of chromosomes. That's why the name of the product is 23andMe. And they are the first and only genetic service available directly to you that includes reports that meet FDA standards. Order your kit today from 23andMe.com.
Science Friday is supported by Math for America. Here's a brain teaser. Where do the best science and math teachers come together to lead, learn, and share? Go ahead and write this down, MFA. MFA fellowships inspire great teachers to stay in the classroom. Learn about the power of the MFA community at mathforamerica.org.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, host of the podcast Note to Self from WNYC, filling in for Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we'll take a look at content moderation, the work being done behind the scenes to keep offensive photos and videos out of your site online. But first, a favorite topic here at Science Friday is the microbiome. We have talked about the microbiome of babies, buildings, even werewolves, but there's a place where bacteria lurk that may still surprise you. The clouds and the sky have a microbiome, too. This week, a study in the journal Nature Communications showed how soil bacteria can hitch a ride on raindrops and float up into the sky. It sounds picturesque, right? But once those bacteria are in the atmosphere, what do they even do up there? What are they interacting with? And how do they affect the weather and climate? Well, my next guests are here to talk about the microbiome above. Cindy Morris is research director at the French National Institute for Agricultural Research in Avignon, France. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Manoush.
Hi. Dr. Nenis. Athanasios Nenis is professor of atmospheric sciences and also chemical and biomolecular engineering at Georgia Tech in Atlanta.
Hello.
Hi. Sorry about ruining your name. People do it to me all the time, so.
Oh, no.
Forgive me.
You did a great job.
And by the way, neither of them were involved in the study published in Nature Communications. And if you, listeners, have questions about how bacteria in the atmosphere might affect us here on the ground, you can call us at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK. Or you can tweet at us at SciFry. So, Cindy, let's start with you. What are the ways we know that bacteria can get transported into the sky? How does it happen?
Well, bacteria are very, very light. And so almost any air movement can lift them up. And generally, air, especially during the day, is, and then there's a net upward movement. And so they're riding these currents from the heat of the soil upward. And they're so light, gravity just doesn't have much force on them. And so that's probably the main driving factor to get them up in the sky, the natural convective movements of the air, turbulence.
And so where are they coming from? Are they just hitching rides on raindrops? Is that what's happening?
Well, the raindrops is called splashing, and probably much of that will come right back down to the ground because those drops are rather heavy. And so most of the bacteria that are going upward are coming either from soil surfaces or mostly plant surfaces. Plants are covered with many, many, many bacteria. Healthy plants are covered with bacteria, and there are bacteria on everything, our skin, all sorts of open surfaces. So these bacteria lift off sort of like dandruff and float up into the atmosphere, and they can go all the way to the stratosphere.
So Athanasios, I understand that as part of a study a few years ago, you actually flew through a hurricane to collect samples of bacteria in the atmosphere. That sounds exciting and dangerous, like you were about 5 miles up. What did you find up there?
So we were actually flying pretty much on the top of the hurricane, the air that comes, you know, at the outflow at the top of one of those systems. And just to see what's there, you know, whenever you get to fly through one of these systems, it's a huge opportunity. You don't, you know, often go through these. And we just wanted to see what's up there, and maybe we could see things like biological particles. So we sampled air masses, and to our surprise, we found that a lot of the larger particles that were around were, to a large extent, biological bacteria. And so, that's what we found. So pretty much it was a surprise to us and a surprise to a lot of the community.
And so there were different types of bacteria up there?
So, yeah, we collected the DNA from these bacteria and we sequenced them. And we identified somewhere around 100 classes of bacteria types And some of them were from oceans. Some of them you can identify them as terrestrial bacteria. And some of them you tend to find them all over the place, about 20 types of them. So around 100 we found, and about 20 were sort of from all over the place.
I mean, you'd think that the conditions would be pretty harsh up there. How do they survive?
So a lot of these, by the time they reach those altitudes, they're completely frozen. So the idea is that perhaps they have mechanisms to cope with these stressors. If you freeze some ice around them, they may, you know, form a protective layer. Water can help, stop some of the stresses from affecting these bacteria. But it's actually unclear at this point what exactly they do. Some bacteria are known to have mechanisms to help cope with UV exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Some are known to withstand drought. Some are known to withstand very high oxidant levels. So perhaps the 20 types that we saw, which you can find everywhere, have just the right sort of machinery to withstand the atmospheric conditions.
Cindy, I wonder if you could tell us, some of the reading I did talked about this idea of ice nucleation. You have worked with bacteria in cloud chambers. Does this mean that bacteria might have play a part in the rainmaking process? Is that what this is about?
Yeah, this is what the big question is. It's been driving research for the past decade. People are very much excited about it. So ice nucleation, roughly, if I were to ask you what temperature water freezes, most of us have learned in school that it freezes at 0 degrees Celsius, which is the temperature above which water cannot turn into solid ice. But below those temperatures, you need a catalyst. And that's what this ice nucleation is. It sort of like kickstarts the freezing process at temperatures warmer than would happen without it. And without it, water can cool down to about minus 39 degrees Celsius, which is about minus 39 degrees Fahrenheit. Hmm. And so most clouds, the cloud tops, rain clouds, are not at these low temperatures. And so in order to start the process that would get cloud droplets to aggregate and become heavy enough to fall, you generally need freezing. In the temperate regions, you need a freezing process where an ice crystal then will collide with droplets that are also cold, but they haven't frozen yet. And this is how the heavy droplets can form.
I feel like I am never going to look out the window of an airplane and see the clouds out there and see them the same way. I mean, Cindy, just to follow up on that, so this is a good thing that bacteria in the clouds can do. Can there be a case of too much of a good thing in this case? Like, can there be too much bacteria in a cloud?
Well, if they're ice nucleation active, some of my physics colleagues have actually discussed this idea with me, which was intriguing. I didn't understand this. But in fact, what happens is that in order for rain to form, you have millions of droplets, tiny droplets in a cloud. And about 10 to the 6th, so one with six zeros after it, have to get together to fall. But most of them need to be liquid to do that. So if all of them were ice crystals, if every cloud droplet had something that could cause ice, that ice would remain suspended in the atmosphere and the cloud would not precipitate. And so, yes, it is possible if you have an excessive amount of ice nucleators in a cloud to actually, what we'll say, constipate the cloud.
And when you get constipated, Athanasius, would the clouds like have lightning? I mean, is that something that could happen then?
So you need to have both water and ice to have lightning occur. And so it's a very interesting situation. Having too many bacteria around, yeah, you would just have ice clouds all over the place.
Okay.
They wouldn't rain out.
But you do need ice, which is a really interesting phenomenon. You do need ice to have lightning. And so we have colleagues in Brazil, atmosphere physicists, who actually injected into a model particles that had the properties of bacterial ice nuclei, and they generated more lightning with them than without them. And so this is another interesting idea that perhaps biological ice nucleators, these microbial particles that can cause ice nucleation, could also have a role in lightning.
So, do you want to add to that, please?
Yeah, so one thing that actually is interesting is that the ice nuclei are always a lot less than the particles that make droplets. So when you have an enhancement of ice nuclei, say you add more bacteria, you would always tend to have that tendency of making more rain and more thunder and lightning. because of that. It's a great point.
Yeah, so I guess I'm wondering, like, what do the bacteria get out of all of this? Like, why would it evolve this kind of life cycle? Is there any indication of that?
Well, we've looked at this. That's part of my research, in fact. We're interested in the ecology. And so first, what happens is that if you look at rainfall, precipitation that has been initiated by ice formation in a cloud, it enriches for ice nucleation active bacteria. So there's more coming down with the rain than there are on a proportion basis per constant volume of water in the cloud. And so the first idea is that we think it just basically helps the bacteria fall out of the clouds because, like you said earlier, the conditions up there are harsh. And if the bacteria remain too long in the clouds, they probably eventually will die. So this is a sure down elevator. The elevator is going down for them, and they need to get on it because otherwise they won't fall on their own.
And so, Dr. Nenez, you actually are also doing flights, if I understand it correctly, over Crete. What are you hoping to find out there?
We're hoping to find what sort of bacteria get blown with the winds when they come from the deserts versus when they come from the continental European lands as well as the Middle East. You know, it's a nice place to be because you have all kinds of air masses, and each air mass has their own characteristic biological particles. And so if you sit around there for long enough, you can actually get a very good idea of who's going to be there at which concentrations, which time of the year. And then once you have a good idea of their properties, you know, how easily they make ice, what are the conditions they need, how much they can withstand the atmospheric stressors, then you can get a much better idea of what's the role of bacteria on cloud formation and precipitation.
Is there any, I mean, you think of bacteria and I think of disease. Is there any evidence that this could occur, that bacteria could spread disease through the air?
Well, the bacteria that, excuse me, caused the ice nucleation, the one that's most well known. There's several types of organisms that do this, but there are bacteria and fungi, the rust fungi, that are also can cause ice nucleation. They are known plant pathogens. Now, it doesn't mean that when they come into contact with a plant, at least for the bacteria, that they'll cause disease. But this is part of their life cycle, and they can cause disease to plants. So it's really interesting because in the future, I mean, a dream for me would be able to ask a farmer one day, okay, here's this season, do you want no rain but healthy crops? Or do you want a little disease and rain? Because I think there's
Oh, we got to leave it there. Sorry, Cindy. After the break, if you don't have graphic violence or other disturbing images online, you can thank a content monitor. We're going to take a look behind the scenes.
Support for Science Friday comes from Blue Apron. Incredible home cooking has never been more attainable thanks to Blue Apron. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers easy-to-follow seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients delivered right to your door. No more overspending at restaurants or high-end grocery stores. With Blue Apron, you can prepare great, memorable meals yourself in under 40 minutes. I really like using Blue Apron. The quality is outstanding, and the food is delicious, like the tasty meals they are featuring in March. They've got vegetable chili and baked sweet potatoes with crispy tortilla strips, spicy shrimp coconut curry with cabbage and rice, and pork chops and miso butter with bok choy and marinated apple. Check out this week's meal menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping. Just go to blueapron.com/science. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So try them today. That's blueapron.com/science. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. And when I'm not subbing for Ira Flatow, I host a podcast about technology called Note to Self. And as you can imagine, I talk to a lot of my listeners on social media, maybe even you. And mostly, these online platforms are safe and well-tended places to be, with lots of news stories, pictures of delicious food, personal updates. We don't expect to see gruesome or disturbing videos or photos of things like beheadings or child pornography, murders, or war zones. And to make sure you don't have disturbing content in your feed, social media companies hire human beings. They're called content moderators, and their job is to inspect and remove any pictures or videos that don't fit company guidelines. We don't have to see it, but these people looking at all this inappropriate content all day long do. How this work affects content moderators' mental health is now at the center of a lawsuit filed against Microsoft. Two former content moderators say filtering pictures and videos all day long, which included reporting child pornography to the authorities, they say it gave them PTSD. And here to explain why this work cannot be automated yet and what it entails are my two next guests. Rochelle LaPlante has been a content moderator for over a decade. She's based in Los Angeles, California, and joins us by Skype. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi.
And Sarah Roberts is an assistant professor of information studies at UCLA. Welcome to Science Friday, Sarah.
Hi, thank you.
So listeners, if you have questions about how content is moderated online, or if you're worried about something else, like the power that content moderators have, do give us a call. We are at 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. So Rochelle, let's start with you. You moderate content for a living. What does your average workday look like?
It kind of varies. It's kind of depending on what's available. I work on a freelance platform that a wide variety of companies use to have text and images and videos moderated. This is usually content that's submitted by users on the site or to the app. So it's my job to go through and review this content and see if it violates any of the guidelines for that particular company. And I have to do this really quickly because it's paid per image. So I have to balance doing it fast enough to make it worth my time, but also make sure I'm doing high quality work at the same time. So it's like modern day piecework, but with the added layer of psychological stress.
Before we go into that part, does it pay well? I mean, is this worth your while?
It kind of depends. Some companies understand that it's difficult work and pay well, and others just don't. And sometimes it's a penny an image, and I have to make the decision about whether I want to spend my time doing that and if I can make it worth my time, or if it's time to go find something else to do with my day.
So can you just talk us through an example of when you saw something that did not fit the guidelines of a company? What happens? What did you see? And then what happens next?
The what happens next part is really difficult because on the platform that I work on, we tag the images that don't fit the company guidelines, but then we don't have any follow-up to know if anything was done about it. So, for example, if I see some child pornography and I tag it as such, I don't know if that's ever reported to the authorities, if the company takes action on it, if these children are helped. There's just no follow-up from that I am understanding or that I see to know what happens with these images.
I mean, I almost hate to ask this question, but what's the worst imagery that you've seen?
Child pornography.
Gosh. And do you know who you're working for, though, when you're doing this work?
No, not at all. The way the platform works is that the companies who post these image sets can use any anonymous name they want. So we really have no idea who we're working for or why we're doing this work.
So, Sarah, I want to go over to you. You are researching content moderation and have spoken to a lot of content moderators. I mean, I think a lot of people, and I know I thought that it was the algorithms that flagged stuff, that robots did this work.
Yeah, I've been looking at the large-scale industrial practice of content moderation since about 2010. That's when I first became aware of it. At that time, I'd been on the internet myself as a pretty prolific user for almost 20 years. And I, too, had never stopped to think about the need for this kind of large-scale for-pay work done in an organized fashion. Mm. So I had two experiences that were repeated over and over again when I brought this up with very knowledgeable scholars, researchers, and other long-term users. The first thing that people would say was, I never thought about that. And then they'd kind of take a pause for a moment, think about it, and then the next question would be, well, don't computers do that? Mm. So that's a pretty common reaction. And I think due in no small part to the fact that the social media industry is predicated on notions of algorithms and smart kinds of computer filtering and other kinds of automated activities going on behind the scenes. But I think the actual social media production cycle is much more complex than that.
Can you just give us a sense of the scale? How many people are doing this work? Where are they doing it? Rochelle, we know you're in LA. Is it mostly here in the States or is it all around the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. Rochelle has described her work environment working for a micro-labor platform, and that is one of several sectors in which this work takes place. Certainly, a number of large-scale, well-known social media technology companies have workers on site who do this work. In many cases, however, those workers tend to be contract laborers. So despite the fact that they're working at the headquarters in Silicon Valley for one of these major firms, they still may not have full employee status. And that can actually really matter when it comes to things like health insurance. Other workers might be working somewhere around the globe on the other side of the world in places like the Philippines, working in call center environments. Although it's important to note that there are call center workers doing commercial content moderation in the United States in places like Iowa. Mm-hmm. There are workers in Europe who do this. So it's really a global practice, and it stands to reason since social media is a 24/7 operation. To answer your question about scope, it's very difficult to have any kind of specific concrete numbers about how many people are involved in this work. But one thing I like to do is look at the user-generated content side to get a sense for the need. In 2014, YouTube was reporting that it was receiving 100 hours of user-generated content to its platform per minute, per day.
Wow.
So if you think about that kind of volume on just one of the major platforms, it becomes apparent that, in fact, the need to have some type of intervention and control over user-generated content is actually paramount. It, in many cases, people within these industries have described it to me as mission critical, which really raises a number of questions as to why it's so invisible.
It's so interesting. As a former foreign news reporter and producer, that was one of my jobs out in the field, you know, to go through mm-hmm. the tape that we brought back from war zones, among other places, and make sure that certain images didn't get out. But what you're talking about is a scale way beyond what I was dealing with TV news, right?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And I think it's important to recognize a couple of things, Manoush. I think your link to the kind of work you did is quite important to make. Of course, in the case of commercial content moderators, unfortunately, they don't have the kind of social support and status that journalists so often do. It's certainly not the professional ethics and sort of mutual kind of recognition from other people in the field and those who consume the material. But also, I should point out that when we're talking about commercial content moderation, really what is being dealt with is really a small subset of all of that content being produced. And much of it doesn't even come to the attention of the commercial content moderators themselves until someone like you or like me or any other user of the platform stumbles across that material and is exposed to it first and then initiates that process of review by flagging the content, sending it to some sort of moderator or what have you. So in many ways, users are implicated very profoundly in this process as well.
These two former workers from Microsoft who filed a lawsuit against the company late last year, they say that their work tracking down child pornography left them with PTSD, hallucinations, permanent disability. I just want to mention that we reached out to Microsoft for a statement, and the spokesperson said that the company uses filtering technology to distort images and reduce their psychological impact. They also provide and require psychological counseling for content moderation workers. And ultimately, they say that they disagree with the plaintiff's claims, and they take employee health and resiliency pretty seriously. But Rochelle, you don't get any sort of support for the work that you're doing at home, presumably.
That's right. Yeah, the freelance platform that I work on doesn't provide any support or any kind of health insurance or benefits or anything of that sort for the workers. All of the support that we have is completely worker-based, and it's workers getting together and providing each other with informal support, but that's the extent of it.
And what do you say to each other? Are there some days where you're just like, I gotta close down the laptop?
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. It's just a lot of talking about, you know, what did you see today and how was it difficult? And sometimes it's just sharing cat photos and funny videos on YouTube to get through it, things that to get your mind off of it, and providing social support to each other.
And Sarah, when you hear about this lawsuit, the workers having PTSD, does that seem like a reasonable complaint to you? And did Microsoft do everything, if it says it did what it says it did, is that everything they could do to minimize the harm?
I'm not inside at Microsoft, and throughout the course of my research up into and including the piece that I wrote for The Atlantic this week, I've had a great deal of trouble kind of getting transparency from the platforms themselves. So it's really hard to know from Microsoft's point of view beyond that statement, you know, how those things translated in terms of worker well-being. One thing we know about this Microsoft case, which is quite interesting to follow, is that the workers started there back in 2007. So it isn't clear to me how many of the kind of filtering techniques that can be employed and some of these other practices that Microsoft articulated in its statement were actually in place at that time. I also wonder what portion of the content that the workers were exposed to was actually material that couldn't be filtered out, that was new user-generated content, didn't exist in a known database already, and therefore had to be reviewed by a human. And then, of course, the question remains to what extent is this material harmful, and at what point does the material become too much? I don't think that is clear or known whatsoever. So it's you know, is it the fact that you could see one too many videos and that's too much for you to have been exposed to, and then you become disabled from the work? Could it happen that you just see one particular video that's too much for you to take? We don't know. I think that's what makes this case so novel. And some of these kinds of blanket statements about best practices and things being in place aren't clear to me that those are necessarily sufficient.
Sarah, I just want to take a call, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A content moderator actually calling in. Is that Jake from Iowa?
Correct.
Hi, Jake. Tell us what you do.
Oh, sure. I'm a corporate content mod for a very large social media company, where I'm constantly going through pictures every day. And paid by the picture. I'm actually an independent contractor for this company. And I've been doing it for 6 years, and you just essentially become numb to it. I often refer or compare it to like being a detective or a coroner, honestly, at that point, because you're so numb to seeing some of these very, very graphic pictures that it just becomes, you know, a daily thing. I mean, see thousands of things that aren't wrong, but then, you know, you do see one or two things regularly that you do have to report. Obviously, the job's not for everybody. I've definitely seen people become mentally unstable doing it, but at the same time, it doesn't happen to everyone.
Jake, thank you so much. I'm Anoush Zomorodi. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Sarah, as you hear Jake describing the work and as you've seen the work being done, what place does this set of practices leave for political speech that looks like pornography or murders or other unwanted content?
Certainly, the issue of commercial content moderation going on social media complicates the notion of these platforms existing as sort of free expression sites for various democratic kinds of engagement. I can give you an example of this. Certainly, if you look at the community guidelines or other kinds of rules and engagement on many of the major platforms, things like violence to children, blood and gore, excessive disturbing material and so on is precluded on these sites. But in the cases that I was looking at, the CCM workers I talked to discussed the fact that they were constantly receiving material from Syria, which is a well-known horrifying war zone. And the material that they were receiving certainly contravened all those guidelines, and yet the policy group that was above them in their particular platform, all of whom were full-time employees, made the decision to allow that material from Syria to stand because it had, in their opinion, an advocacy goal. Certainly seems laudable and makes sense in context, but what the worker in this case pointed out to me is that he also saw all kinds of other material coming from different types of war zones all over the world that was disallowed from being put online. And so he made the pretty apt and astute connection that whether or not it was an intentional decision at the policy level, there seemed to be a mechanism that allowed material to stand that was, in fact, in line with U.S. foreign policy in that particular region, and other material that would have been less favorable didn't stand. So this certainly has, you know, we know that social media material has immense political implications, and we know that coming out of the 2016 election, if for no other reason. We've talked a lot about fake news and these kinds of things, but I think the CCM work and the role that these individuals have in curating and gatekeeping content online is quite under discussed.
Rochelle, and we don't have a lot of time left, but I'm wondering, what would you like listeners to know about the work that you do, or what it's like to be when you're online and you think it just Facebook just shows up like that?
I think the most important thing for me that I want people to know is that it's not computers and it's not AI that are doing this work. It's actual human beings. And when you're scrolling through your Facebook feed or your Twitter feed or whatever social media you're using and not seeing those images, just to take a moment to realize that there's humans that are doing that and making that appear that way. And it's not some computer system that's handling it all for you.
And Sarah, any last word before we go?
I think I just want to acknowledge the fact that many of these workers are under non-disclosure agreements that are quite severe, and the penalties of violating them usually are termination, if not other consequences. So I really appreciate the workers who I've spoken with who are willing to talk about these practices so we can know about them. If nothing else, we know if this were all automated, computers don't violate NDAs.
Many thanks to Rochelle LaPlante, a content moderator in L.A., and Assistant Professor of Information Studies Sarah T. Roberts. After the break, a forager and a chef are here to talk about how you can transform scraps, peelings, and old lettuce into a scrumptious meal. Creative cooking that could solve the world's food waste problem. Stay with us.
Hey, Sci-Fi listeners. All this month, I'm asking you to do something special, something simple. Tell a friend about a podcast. Any podcast. Think of a friend, think of a podcast they would really love, okay? That's all you have to do. Suggest a podcast when you speak to them or on social media. And if they're podcast newbies, have never listened to one, show them how to listen. Then tell us what you recommended with the hashtag Tripod, TRYPOD. Thanks for the favor.
This is Science Friday. I'm Manoush Samarodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. There's that old expression, waste not, want not. But sadly, most of us, in the developed world at least, seem to have forgotten it. In the U.S., we throw out a third of our food, a full third. Every year, tens of billions of pounds of perfectly good food are wasted. And I know we've all been there, that misshapen tomato with a bruise, it's way too ugly to slice up for your salad, right? Or that hunk of cheese with that little green mold spot, you could have cut it off, but you just threw it in the garbage instead. Or maybe you just didn't know what to do with those dirty carrot tops or cabbage cores and broccoli stems, so they ended up in the trash. Is there anything you could do with them? Well, my next guests, a Danish chef and a fine dining forager, are here to keep that stuff out of the garbage and get it onto your kitchen table. They will literally make you want to scrap your dinner plans with their new book, Scraps, Wilt and Weeds, Turning Wasted Food into Plenty. You can check out an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/scraps. And I want to introduce to you Mads Rafslund. He is a chef based here in New York City. He's the founder of Noma, that famous restaurant in Copenhagen, and he's co-author of Scraps, Wilt, and Weeds. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And Tama Matsuoka Wong is a professional forager for restaurants here in the New York City area, and she's Mad's co-author.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. You brought me some goodies, which I'm going to eat in a minute. I want to welcome you both, and I want to ask you, listeners, we want to know what's in your fridge. Call in, give us your tired, your wilted, your stale ingredients, and Mads and Tama are going to tell you what to do with them. Our number is 844-724-8255. That's 844-SCI-TALK, or you can tweet us at SciFry. So, Mads, I want to start. You live here in New York City now. And this is a place where, of course, there are trash bags piled up on every corner. Sometimes it smells like rotten food. Not today. It's too cold today. But instead of this being a turnoff for you, you kind of write that you find a lot of inspiration from trash.
Yeah. You know, if you go down the West Village, or if you go to the East Village or something, and you see all the trash on the street, you're not getting inspired by that, of course. I get a little bit sad about it.
Right.
But, yeah, when I see, like, a Christmas tree lying on the ground after Christmas evening, or you see the pumpkins after Halloween's and all this, yeah, get inspired. You can use that for something.
Just to, like, give us a little taste of what you could use it for. I mean, in the book, I have to say I was really astounded by pumpkin jerky. That was not something I would have thought to make.
But there's so many, you know, pumpkins that's throwing out after Halloween. So we did so many things with the pumpkin. We dried it. And we made flowers with it. We could use it for pasta. We can use it for teas. We can use it for soups, whatever. And jerky also, of course, yeah.
Of course, jerky, right.
Of course. You can just, you know, we dry it for days. It took a long time
Did
to
it?
Dry it, yeah.
Oh,
very long
it's
time.
That is tasty. Tama, you forage professionally for restaurants here in New York City. What is foraging, actually? Like, what's your day like?
My day? Well, it's different most of the time, but foraging is really finding things in nature. So I think that you're finding things that are in nature, and you're picking them and finding deliciousness in them.
But I mean, if you're doing it for restaurants, you must have to find a lot of deliciousness.
Yes, there's a lot of logistics involved in that. And doing it as a business is different. It's much easier just to do it for yourself in your backyard.
Right.
But obviously, if you're going to do it as an innovative business, there's a lot of logistics and discovery, but
and
always
secret
challenging.
Secret spots, yes. I bet, too. Now, you brought me something, and you told me I should really only eat the... What am I holding here?
So right now, people may think there's nothing out there now because actually it's snowing here in
yes.
New York. But there's some things that are wild that grow in this snow, and that is garlic pennycress.
Can I eat it?
Yes.
It's a little spicy. Oh, this is good.
It's good, right? So
I want a little like cheese with
it's
that.
Actually, it's really interesting. We think that this is something pretty new in that if you look at some of the old books that are out there, they don't have this particular species. So this is a species that hybridized between two different mustards in the wild.
Huh.
And that's why it has that kind of sweetness and complexity. It's not just plain bitter.
Yeah, it's yummy. Yeah. So, Mads, what sort of things were you looking around in your kitchen as a chef and thinking, like, golly, I wish I could find a way to use something? I know that Brussels sprouts was something that you thought, I love Brussels sprouts.
I think, you know, I'm using everything, you know, but there's some things you cannot eat, of course. But Brussels sprouts have stemmed for that. It took us a long time to break that code. But actually, if you grill them and you cut into the center, you have like the heart of the Brussels sprouts.
You're talking about like when we go to the farmer's
market.
The stock,
the big stock where all the Brussels sprouts are growing from.
There are New Yorkers and maybe other people across the country who have only ever seen Brussels sprouts in like a mesh bag, and that's how they've bought them.
Exactly. But I like to see it as a wholeness. You know, you see the whole plant, the whole ingredient.
I think that's one of the main points that Mads is, you know, what we're working together, is that he always wants to go back to see how it actually lives as a whole in nature. Because if you can see the thing as a whole, then you can start to see what all the infinite possibilities are from it. But if you only see it in a little package of parts, you only think of it one way.
Right. That is so true. Okay, let's take a call. I think we have John calling from Menlo Park in California. Hey, John.
Hi.
What's going on? What you got there?
Not much. Just hanging out. I have old potatoes that are kind of sprouting a little bit, if you know what I mean.
Yep, I do. They have little flowers coming out of them.
Yeah, and then some tortilla chips that are almost stale, not quite.
Okay, this is good.
Yeah.
This is good. Okay, John, I'm going to put it to them. Thanks for calling.
So I can start off.
Okay.
That If it is green, this is something we did research, we talked about, and we do actually have sort of scientific experts that we work with at NRDC who look at the scientific side. And if you have green on your potatoes, you actually, if they have turned green,
yes,
you should not be eating the green part. They do have toxins.
John, did
but
you
if
hear
they're
that?
Not yet green, they should still be okay if you cut away the sprouty bits.
So just cut off the top. That part, stick it in the compost, but use the, even if, what if they're a little bit like smushy, the potatoes?
Smushy or wrinkle? What?
I don't know. You tell me.
If it's smushy, like rotten, yeah, you should not eat it. But if it's like a wrinkle and old in a way, you can still eat them.
Okay.
You can do amazing things with the potato peelings, actually. We did a soup out of it. We did like infusions in oils, all these.
Isn't it
things.
Really bitter, a potato peeling?
Just wash them. No, it's not. No, it's not bitter, bitter, no. It tastes like if you roast all the peelings
yeah.
in the oven, it tastes like baked potatoes.
Oh, when you really? Do
yeah, we have a soup in the book that's like with baked potatoes. It's a taste of baked potatoes. It's a soup of baked potatoes. So it's just a peeling from potatoes.
And so, and the tortilla chips, I think he should just crumble them up and toast them. What do you think?
Yeah, like
right.
I'm not
getting
so
in the mood here.
I'm not so much into like processed food. So.
Oh, sorry, John.
But the potato skin is sometimes also has some of the nutrition. Actually, is in most nutrition is skin. So peeling off the peel of the potatoes seems really like a waste in more than one way.
Okay, so Crystal is calling from Hot Springs, Arkansas. Crystal, what you got in your kitchen?
Well, my husband and I have recently started juicing, and there's a lot of pulp left, and I'm not sure what to do with all of it. It feels wasteful just to only compost it, so I was wondering what else I can do with all of the pulp left.
Such a good question. Thanks, Crystal. Mads, are you a juicer?
Yeah, I have a juicer. And it's actually, we're using juice pulp for a lot of different things. To start with, if you want to use it fresh, you can you put it into falafel. You could do it in like Dan Barber is using it for a vegan burger.
Burgers, yeah.
Yeah, veg burgers. And I think he sold it at Shake Shack.
Shake Shack was even selling veggie burgers from, I think.
From juicing pulps?
Yes.
Yeah. Huh. So the next day we were drying it and polarize it into flour. And we use it for pastas. Put it into water or into a cup and put hot water on it. You have a mixable like bouillon.
And I actually read in the book, Mads, that your girlfriend would take some of the pulp and turn it into like a scrub for the shower.
Yes, true. She did that.
So you're eating it, you're scrubbing it. It's there's so many uses. I love
that. And again, not to kind of put on the health thing, but a lot of the fiber that is good for you in the vegetables actually in the pulp, and should not be throwing it away if you can't.
All right. I want to go to Sue Ellen, who's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Sue Ellen.
Hi.
Tell us your ingredients.
Withered apples.
Mm-hmm. Anything
and,
else?
Yellowish parsley.
Oh, that's a good one.
And I have some chickweed. It's not too withered up yet, but I don't know too many things to do with it, so I thought they might have some more ideas.
Cool.
I do forage.
Oh, you
that.
Forage right. as well. Okay, very cool. Thanks, Sue Ellen. All right, so withered apples, chickweed, and yellowed parsley. I have been a victim of the yellow parsley, and I usually just
the parsley,
it.
In a way, when you buy herbs, generally, and it's in the recipe, you only need like half of the amount of herbs you have. Instead of putting it back into the fridge, just hang it up and dry it.
Oh.
So it's the same thing when you go to a supermarket and buy the dry herbs. You actually just have them hanging in your kitchen. So don't put them back into the fridge because you forget about them.
Yeah, and then they're moldy and then you're sad.
And yellow, it's not because it's bad. You can still like boil it and still use it or dry it. It's just a stage of, you know, getting into the next level. with the apples, I have worked a lot with these apples, like a little bit brute, and it's like ugly fruits in a way.
Yeah,
we call
yeah.
it. And we dry it into raisins. We have a dessert with it. Because it's almost like a natural thing with the apples falls down to the ground and lying in soil, in the grass. It's starting to bring down. It starts to ferment, and it's getting sweet, and later on it rots. So we did actually a dessert with that, calling falling fruits, and we had taken like Winkle's apples and cut into small pieces. Cooked it in simple syrup and was drying it for a day, and after that, it was like looking like raisins.
Dessert. There are tons of things you can do with withered apples. They're not, as long as they're not rotten. You know, you can bake with them. There are lots of things. I'll say something about the chickweed.
Yeah, tell us.
The chickweed.
What is chickweed?
Oh, so chickweed is it's a small herbaceous plant weed that grows all over people's gardens. And actually, being of Asian ethnicity, it is actually one of the seven precious herbs of spring for Japanese. Mm-hmm. They don't call it chickweed, so therefore, you know, probably is fairly much a gourmet item there. Mm-hmm. And it's very mild. So if you're just chopping up, you could have it as an Asian dish, or you can substitute it for spinach. One way we like to do it, a Western way, would be to chop it up and use it for a topping for like a bruschetta or a toast or something. And another is sort of a classic way with sesame and soy sauce and a little bit of sugar that you could have as a side dish.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Mads, one thing that makes me sad, I'm crazy for coffee, and especially like really good coffee. It seems, I want to be rummage around in my coffee beans, but is there anything I could do with them? Like the ground after I make
the
myself?
Ground, yeah, definitely. I have used it so many times because, you know, it's a shame to throw all these coffee grounds away after. So you can reuse it. You know, in Africa or other places in the world, they don't throw it out after. They're rebrewing it again and again and again and again because there's so much flavor, leftover flavor in it. So I've done like a panna cotta with it.
Mm.
So actually, instead of throwing it out after you've done your cappuccino espresso thing, you just put it into milk or cream and boil it up one more time, and you have all the flavors of the leftover coffee taste.
Could that be like a latte for later in the morning? Mm. Or is it not going to have enough flavor?
It could be.
I'm going to try it.
You should try it. Okay. Or you could use it into a body scrub again.
Right, or a body scrub. Everything, just making a body
scrub. It's actually really good, that one, yeah.
It sounds so good. Yum. Okay, so Tama, one thing that I feel particularly guilty about is like I cut up, my family eats ridiculous amounts of carrot sticks, which is great, but after reading your book, I'm wondering if we're going about this all wrong in that I cut the tops off and I cut the bottom off and I scrape off the skin because, like, my kids, the minute anything looks a little brown, they're not going to eat it. But is that total waste?
I don't see why you should have to peel off the peel of the carrot, I guess, if you're asking. And then the tops, of course, the tops can be used as a green. And I think for myself, and just sort of easy and not having too much time, a lot of the pestos that are there, including the carrot tops, the celery scraps, are some of my favorite recipes. So they're so easy. And the main difference for myself and people who were testing it was that they had this image in their mind that, oh, this is going to taste like straw and be all bad, but it actually tastes delicious.
Okay.
And I would just tell people, try it, and you'll be really surprised.
Carrot tops?
Carrot tops is good, yeah.
Just eat them.
Well, you chop them up, right?
I will bring it down with something because it's a little bit bitter. So.
Okay.
Yeah, so there's a recipe about how to kind of balance, and it turns out really well, but you're not just taking a hunk of carrot tops and eating it like Bugs Bunny.
I like that image, though. So we've mostly talked about vegetables. Can we delve into like things that are a little bit dicier? Meat, for example. We got a tweet from Aggie80 said, "What do you do with meat that is freezer burned?" Anything?
You can still use it. You know,
you can?
Yeah, you can still use it. It's just...
is it not
going to
taste?
I don't eat
good?
So much. I don't think there's not so much waste in proteins.
Freezer burn is what? Just
freezer
explain
burn is like
for
you
me.
Take something out and you're like, oh my God, how long has this been in the freezer? And it has like a crust of like crystals on it. And you're thinking, this just, well, forget it. There's no resurrecting this piece of meat.
I can't use it in a curry or something like that.
Use it in a curry. So
well,
just go for it, Aggie. Okay, go for it. But maybe use it something
you're not dying
with more flavor.
I don't think you are.
Okay, so use more spices maybe to have it make it more flavorful? Would that
or
be?
If there, I don't know what the freezer burn has done, if it's done something with the texture or something, mm-hmm. like which it sounds like. So if you've done something with the texture, then a slow cooking with like a robust sauce like a stew or a curry mm-hmm. should not... It shouldn't bring, you know, you're not slicing it really thin mm-hmm. so that you're trying to get a certain texture out of what you're doing. You're doing something that doesn't focus on the texture of it as much.
Okay, this is a tweet from Dez. He wants to know, I have old onions that are sprouting green tails. Are they still usable?
I've used the sprouted onions before, yeah.
Yeah, the green on the onions is not the same problem as green on potatoes.
Oh, okay.
It should be fine.
So just go for it. Think
go
of yourself
it, yeah.
as having two vegetables instead of one now.
Exactly. It's spring onions.
I love it. Okay. This is great. Now, this I have, this one's really good. From Helix, what can I do with lightly moldy bagels? I have three.
With what? Sorry.
Moldy. Slightly moldy bagels. I'm going to guess nothing.
If it's moldy, no, I will not use it.
I'm sorry, Helix.
Or you could, I don't know, how can you cut off the moldy? Is it, if it's slightly?
But day-old bread, we have a great recipe for that.
Yeah, day-old, there's tons of.
There's so many good recipes. Many, many thanks to Mads Refslund, acclaimed Danish chef now based here in New York, co-author of Scraps, Wilts, and Weeds, along with Tama Matsuoka Wong, the fine dining forager, his co-author. We have an excerpt of the book and a few recipes, too. That's up at sciencefriday.com/scraps. Check it out. Let us know what you made in the comments or post a yummy picture on Twitter or Facebook. Sorry about the bagels. Meanwhile, though, BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks goes to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. You can always email us. The address here is scifry@sciencefriday.com. Ira will be back next week. Don't worry. But meanwhile, you can hang out with me at notetoselfradio.org. Note to Self is a podcast from WNYC. In New York, I'm Manoush Samarodi. Thank you so